Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor at the European Parliament in Strasbourg.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's London correspondent in Westminster. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
This week, the House of Commons was suspended under the British government's deeply controversial prorogation. But that did not mean a quiet week for Boris Johnson.
Yes, the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, population 614,000, has been added to the roll call of places where Brexiters feel their Prime Minister has been humiliated.
We'll revisit Boris Johnson's torrid meeting with Luxembourg Prime Minister Xavier Bettel and, more importantly, his meeting with the Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker beforehand, where, according to officials, he was schooled in the complexities of the Northern Ireland backstop.
Meanwhile, the Supreme Court here in London is the latest arena in which a high-stakes constitutional wrestling match is being played out. Will the court decree that the prorogation of Parliament was a constitutional outrage, or just the government of the day enjoying its electoral powers?
And while my learned gentlemen ponder the finer points of law, time is running out. We'll assess where the negotiations on the backstop are at and what prospects there might be for a deal in time to avoid a crash-out Brexit.
And we'll be joined by Sam McBride of the Belfast Newsletter on the DUP's position and if they're prepared to move on the backstop.
But first, Sean, Parliament may be prorogued, but Westminster is still in legal and political turmoil.
Well, Tony, strange to say, it is in legal and political turmoil. Yes, the Parliament is suspended or prorogued, to use the ancient term. It's current around this way. But that doesn't stop politicians, of course, doing what politicians do. And there's all kinds of interventions in the media, speech making, and then you've got the governmental activity as well going on related to Brexit. That's mostly in public, but also, obviously, a fair bit of stuff going on behind the scenes as well. Then you've got people getting ready for their party conferences, so normal politics as usual going on in as much as it can go on, given that there's no parliament sitting in town. But of course there's the legal turmoil as well, as you mentioned, and the big issue that is dominating the week here in Westminster is that Supreme Court action, where you have the government and the parliament effectively battling it out via proxies in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court acting as the referee in this battle between government and parliament. And of course, the argument that's being made by the supporters of parliament is that parliament is the sovereign power here in the United Kingdom, in the constitutional setup here, that the government is effectively subordinate to parliament and therefore should not have the ability to suspend parliament as and when it sees fit to do so. The government, of course, trying to make a counter-argument there and saying, well, no, what we're doing is normal, but we had that intervention during the week on behalf of Sir John Major, the former Conservative Prime Minister, saying that what was being done by Boris Johnson was not in conformity with the custom and practice and traditions and indeed legality of suspending the Parliament. And he ought to know because he himself had prorogued the Parliament at one stage. So he also, of course, has all the weight of office of having been the Prime Minister and having been a long-serving parliamentarian as well. So that intervention, I think, was a pretty significant thing coming in on the side of those who argue that what the government of Mr. Johnson has done is not right. They also made much of the fact that the government itself had not been able to find anybody to swear an affidavit to the effect that what they were doing was correct and that all the documentation that they'd submitted in support of their case was fully correct as well. So they were trying to highlight that to the judges. But yes, we saw out on the streets a fairly carnival-like atmosphere, certainly on the opening morning, certainly something that the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom has not seen before.
So just to remind people, we obviously have the legal channels that have been working their way up to the Supreme Court, trying to figure out whether or not the prorogation was legal. But we've also had the Benn Act, which effectively prohibits the government legally from a crash-out Brexit at the end of October and obliges Boris Johnson to go and seek an extension if he doesn't get a deal at the October summit on the withdrawal agreement. But as you mentioned there, it's by no means clear that a no deal can be avoided, because it seems that number 10 is still angling or manoeuvring to somehow sidestep that obligation to go to Brussels and seek an extension.
Well, yes. I mean, the government doesn't like being under an obligation to the parliament. They want to run the Brexit policy their way. And, you know, if I was in Boris Johnson's shoes, I suppose I would want to have the maximum flexibility to pursue my policy my way, rather than having hundreds of parliamentarians effectively looking over my shoulder at all of the moves and manoeuvres. And of course, the central tenet of the whole Johnson approach to trying to get changes to the withdrawal agreement has been this idea that you must present the European Union with a credible threat of leaving the EU without a deal, of just crashing out on the 31st of October, do or die, to coin a phrase. If that policy is frustrated by this law that the Parliament has passed, the so-called Benn Act, and it, on the surface of it, it appears to tie the government's hands, in as much as the government is required to go to Brussels to get a deal and then come back to the Parliament and offer the Parliament a chance to vote on that deal. And if that is rejected, then it must offer the Parliament a chance to vote on leaving without a deal. But if the Parliament say, no, we don't want to leave with no deal either, then he's under a legal obligation to go back to Brussels and seek an extension of time. And that is something that he has adamantly set himself against doing. He says, no, I'm not going to go back and ask for it. So, yes, we've been seeing all kinds of notions of potential ways out, of manoeuvres, of extra prorogations of the Parliament, all kinds of things to avoid the Prime Minister having to go back. How much of that is real? How much of it is just top of the head stuff? How much of it is deliberate provocation to try and keep the situation slightly unstable or on the boil? Who knows? But yes, it's something that on the surface of it, Prime Minister Johnson has certainly set himself firmly against doing. He does not want to go cap in hand to Brussels and say, please, sir, can we have more time?
Meanwhile, Sean, briefly, we've had the other, I suppose, wild card of the Liberal Democrats. They've been having their annual conference in Bournemouth, and their new leader, Joe Swinson, has struck a fairly robust and clear-cut position on Brexit, namely that if she became Prime Minister, which we accept is a fairly unlikely scenario given their small numbers to date in the House of Commons, even though they seemingly keep getting new members walking across the division to join them, that she would, if Prime Minister, revoke Article 50 altogether. Now, I assume that is a way to try and appeal to disenchanted Labour supporters who feel that Labour's position is just still way too ambiguous on Brexit.
Well, I think the Liberal Democrats will take votes not just from disenchanted Labour supporters, but disenchanted Conservative supporters, and indeed disenchanted supporters of any other political party that they can attract to their cause. I mean, some professional observers thought that Joe Swinson coming out so firmly in favour of repealing Brexit if she became Prime Minister was a tactical error.
So obviously, Boris Johnson is sticking with his do or die, come what may, message of exiting the European Union by the end of October, even though he still hasn't fully squared how he will do that and comply with the Benn Act, the law, as you mentioned. But this is probably a good time to just remind people of what happened in Luxembourg this week, because, of course, he is still saying that he's straining every sinew to get an agreement with the European Union to replace the backstop, to have a deal that everybody can live with by the end of October. A huge amount of scepticism, of course, in Dublin and other EU capitals. But one of those capitals he visited on Monday was Luxembourg, where he was due to meet Jean-Claude Juncker, the Commission President. Now, the announcement of that happened the previous Friday, so there was a flurry of speculation that this was a last-minute announcement and that something was in the air, some breakthrough perhaps in the talks was afoot. But in fact, this was, according to people I've spoken to, simply a scheduling diary issue, and that if Boris Johnson hadn't met Jean-Claude Juncker in Luxembourg, then the only opportunity he would have had to meet him would be at the European Council on the 17th and 18th of October, and that would not be a really ideal situation. Now, we can talk about the lunch he had with Jean-Claude Juncker in a moment, but of course that visit was dominated by his meeting with Xavier Bettel, who is the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, not one to be shy about expressing his true feelings about Brexit and the state of play in the negotiations. And he has, over time, expressed quite a bit of frustration about Theresa May's negotiating tactics and the lack of a clear position by the UK on its future relationship with the EU. And what happened was Boris Johnson arrived at the Prime Minister's office in Luxembourg, and a small, I think, gathering of anti-Brexit supporters, these were mainly British expats living in Luxembourg, had arrived, and there was quite a lot of booing and quite a bit of noise. One chap had a megaphone and was also singing Ode to Joy, the European hymn. And by the time the meeting with Xavier Bettel was over, the British had felt that the noise outside was just too much and that the press conference should actually happen inside the office of the Luxembourg Prime Minister. Now, what happened was that that did not come about. Boris Johnson then left the office of the Prime Minister amid a cacophony of boos and noise, and then left Xavier Bettel to conduct the press conference by himself, the so-called empty chairing of Boris Johnson, because of course Boris Johnson's lectern was empty and Xavier Bettel was there talking to journalists. Now, the worst thing, I suppose, from a British point of view was that even not only was the lectern empty, but Bettel then seemed to tear into the British negotiating strategy and scolded Boris Johnson, who wasn't obviously standing beside him, on British tactics, and excoriated Brexiteers for what they had done in terms of not planning for a Brexit, not planning for the outcome of the referendum, and then seeming to put the blame on the EU. So it was a double humiliation, if you like, for Boris Johnson.
So now it's on Mr. Johnson. He holds the future of all UK citizens. We need a deal that protects the Good Friday Agreement and avoids a hard border on the Irish island at all costs.
And then Downing Street let it be known that he had tried to keep the press conference inside, but he was overruled. The Luxembourgers simply refused. Now, I did speak to somebody from the Luxembourg government who said that the request to move everything inside was very short notice and last minute, and it would have been impossible to suddenly bring in 140 accredited journalists into a tiny press conference room in the office. But of course, by that stage, social media was entirely polarised and divided over who was right and who was wrong. But the whole episode actually eclipsed the fact that at his meeting with Jean-Claude Juncker previously, it was a two-hour meeting, and according to people I've spoken to, he didn't bring forward any new concrete proposals, but it was seen by the Commission as a useful exercise in really schooling Boris Johnson on the nature of the backstop, what it was there for, what it was technically designed to do. And Stephanie Rizzo, who is a fairly formidable official in Michel Barnier's task force, seemed to lay it on the line about why his idea of an All-Ireland food regime simply wouldn't go far enough. It just didn't work with the way that the backstop works. It would not be compatible with the EU single market. It's a customs union which delivers a regulatory union, and you can't simply strip out bits and pieces as you go. So I think that was what was seen by the Commission as perhaps a positive out of Boris Johnson's trip to Luxembourg. Now, of course, Downing Street has dismissed as nonsense any reporting that Boris Johnson was somehow slumped in his chair when he realised the complexity of the backstop and the Irish border question. But it does bring us to a position now where clearly Boris Johnson's offer to the EU, which is an all-Ireland agri-food zone plus alternative arrangements, notably technology, trusted trader schemes, exemptions and so on, which won't be ready in time for the end of the transition, that they would be a kind of a bolt-on to the All-Ireland agri-food regime. And then you would have a Stormont lock. In other words, Stormont would have to give its approval for any kind of regulatory alignment in the agri-food sphere. And that would be pretty much a three-point plan for Boris Johnson that he has articulated at these meetings, but of course he hasn't tabled it formally as a text. Now, this is probably a good time to bring in Sam McBride, who is a correspondent with the Belfast Newsletter, who has been following Brexit very closely and has written some very penetrating articles on how the DUP is positioning itself over the Brexit period. Sam, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on. Can you give us a sense of how the DUP is coping with this pressure at the moment from civil society, from business groups and so on, because they don't really want to be seen as the party that facilitated a no-deal Brexit?
That's right, Tony. There is pressure in particular, I think, from the DUP's point of view, from farmers, and that is a sore point for the DUP. They are a party which is pretty strong in rural parts of Northern Ireland. There is a significant hinterland there. The likes of the Ulster Farmers Union is an organisation which really, in historic terms, has always been very close to the DUP, and certainly under the Stormont system, it was pretty rare that there was a divergence between the DUP and the Ulster Farmers Union. Now they are on pretty radically different positions on this, and that is an uncomfortable position for them. But I think the bigger change for the DUP has not been the voice of business in Northern Ireland or even the voice of farmers in Northern Ireland. I think it has been the very significant shift in the arithmetic in the House of Commons. It has been the arrival of Dominic Cummings in particular in Downing Street, and the sense that whereas there was this period of really inertia under the leadership of Theresa May, now there is the realization that something is going to happen by the end of October, and I do not think that there is a trust from the DUP in Boris Johnson. They say publicly that they believe that he will not sell them out, but I think if you put yourself in the DUP's shoes, what else do they say? They really have to pin their hopes on Boris at this point, but there is no sense, I think, in a genuine way from the DUP that they really believe what he is saying here. He has betrayed them, as they see it, once this year already, when he voted for the backstop, having come to their conference and really said that would be unconscionable and no British Prime Minister could ever endorse something of that nature. So it is clear that his approach to pledges is much more fluid than you would like it to be if you're in their shoes. And so therefore there is this calculated change to the tone of Arlene Foster's language. It is not a case of her misspeaking or blundering into something. They are very deliberately, I think, preparing their base for what will be at least the potential for compromise. But as you say, there is no guarantee that what they are prepared to offer is going to be anything like enough for either Dublin or for Brussels. And therefore, all of this may ultimately come to nothing.
Yeah, I think that's a real risk, Sam. And also, I think in the past, when the DUP have had to prepare their base, they've had to take quite a long time to do it. But yet, if they're going to shift substantively over towards the EU position and bring their base with them, they're going to have to do it in pretty quick time and in short order. We have seen a shift in tone from people like Nigel Dodds, Sammy Wilson, Geoffrey Donaldson. How far do you think the DUP can go on this? I mean, they have talked about perhaps an All-Ireland animal health and food safety zone, but they seem to have drawn the line on customs because that's a much more binary constitutional, if you like, red line for them.
I think that all of these elements, and of course Brexit itself, have got very significant constitutional implications. I mean, that is at the heart of this. It comes down to how laws are made, who has representation, who is able to have a power of veto, and so therefore who is able to have jurisdiction over various parts of territory. And that is very much the way in which the DUP has presented this up until this point. So it is very difficult for them to turn around at the last moment when it's obvious that they're under pressure and suddenly just say, well, it's a few regulations here and there. This is about trade and business and really won't have any significant impact on the constitutional arrangements. That is difficult for them. Having said that, I think there are a couple of things that are in the DUP's favour here. Most normal people in Northern Ireland, as in probably most of the rest of Europe, don't really understand the detail of this. It's fiendishly complicated. Nobody could be blamed for not understanding this. And also, they are just fed up to the back teeth with Brexit. They want it to go away. They want it to be resolved. That does not guarantee that if it's resolved in a way that they don't want, that they will be happy with that. But there is just a sense that a lot of people just are tired of the whole thing. And so therefore, because the DUP have been seen up to this point as the hardliners, as the people who are really pushing back against any sort of constitutional divergence for Northern Ireland, if they're happy with it, if they sell it, if they're enthusiastic about this and they're united about this, there is the potential that they really can bring at least a lot of their supporters with them on this. In the opposite column, I suppose, there is the danger that not only have they presented this from the outset as a constitutional threat to the union, and that is something which unionists over a very long period have felt acutely. They do not trust London to look out for their interests. There is a sense of constantly being under threat for a lot of unionists, and they certainly, I think, do not trust somebody like Boris Johnson. Therefore, if they are in a position where the DUP are trying to sell this, having built up this sense of threat, that will be a difficult sell. It will require a very capable leader of unionism. I think the difficulty that Arlene Foster has is that she has been weakened over recent years. And so therefore, if she is somebody who is putting her career on the line, if you like, over this issue, people within the DUP who are not happy at her, who do not think that she is somebody who has shown herself to be across the detail of other things over recent years, there would be a point here where I think she would be vulnerable and where there could be a move against her. So can she keep the DUP united? Can she keep them behind her on this? I think a lot of questions there are lots of questions that it's not really clear what the answers to those will be at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, the way the Irish government see this this particular moment that we're in, I mean, clearly what Boris Johnson has suggested, as I mentioned, so an All-Ireland agri-food zone plus alternative arrangements, the so-called MaxFac and a Stormont lock. I mean, I think the view in Dublin and Brussels is that while this is a step in the right direction, you know, it really doesn't go nearly far enough to meet the objectives of the original backstop, if you like. And I have to say that, you know, reporting here from Strasbourg this week, there were, you know, fairly resounding declarations of support for Ireland by different political groups. And also, again, you had people like Jean-Claude Juncker and Michel Barnier articulating what the backstop was about, you know, talking about communities along the border who live and work, these integrated supply chains, the economic model along the border, that was really what the backstop was designed to protect and preserve. And it was, as they would see it, you know, a pragmatic solution to a complex problem that Brexit presented. So I think the cursor will shift now on this whole notion of consent and what kind of mechanism or role that the Assembly might get in the future. Now, obviously, the immediate problem is that the Assembly isn't up and running. There's still a great deal of distrust between the two parties on this. And as well as that, it should be remembered that when, you know, if you're either applying EU law or you're not, and if you are applying EU law, once those laws have been enacted and transposed and legislated for by, you know, 27 member states, nobody can come along and say, well, we don't like that law and we don't like this law, but we do like that law, so we'll pick and choose which ones we apply. I mean, the EU simply won't work like that. So there has to be some kind of mechanism that gives unionism a sense of ownership or a sense of oversight that doesn't amount to a veto. And I think, I suppose, because the Assembly has not been up and running and is a fragile creature, then you wouldn't want to necessarily burden a freshly revived Assembly with a big constitutional issue. So I think that's going to be a major problem. And it's really hard from my vantage point to see how all of these issues can be resolved in time for the 31st of October. So that's where things are at the moment. There have been some movement. Steve Barclay, the Brexit Secretary, has given a very confrontational, combative speech in Madrid, effectively warning the Spanish government about the devastating effect no deal would have on the Spanish economy, on fruit and veg producers in Spain, on Spanish tourism, on Spanish fisheries, but also a warning to the Irish government that two-thirds of medicines in Ireland actually come from Great Britain and 40% of Irish exports to the EU go through the British land bridge. So whatever talk there is about constructive progress, I mean, the tone of the speech by Stephen Barclay was really quite astonishing. There are obviously a lot of contacts being made, but I do think that you painted a picture there, Sean, of you know, so many things happening at so many different levels, political, legal, technical, and the idea that all of this is magicked into a solution, like a nick of time solution at the European Council or even shortly afterwards, still seems to me a remote prospect, especially given that, you know, the public and private presentations by the British side of completely stripping out the backstop and replacing it with this trio of solutions is just so far short of what Ireland could politically and accept and what the EU could legally accept. And the idea that, you know, after 2 years of negotiations leading all the way up to the Strasbourg instruments being negotiated and all of the clarifications that we saw at the early part of this year, for the EU to suddenly just tear up chunks of that in and then replace it with something that's a lot weaker, in their view, just seems to me not a credible expectation by the British side. But we shall see what happens. And obviously, we will be keeping everybody up to date as best we can as all these events unfold. So I think we can leave it there. And we'll be back again with more of the same next week. Who knows where we'll be with the Supreme Court and those technical papers and technical discussions that are continuing in Brussels between the British side and the European Commission. But I would like to warmly thank Sam McBride from the Belfast Newsletter for joining us today, giving us very insightful views on the DUP's positioning and all of this. And also thanks very much again to my colleague in London, Sean Whelan, and from me, Tony Connolly, the RT Europe editor in Strasbourg. Thanks once again for listening.